Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of precision.
Right.
It's almost like engineering. You
Yeah.
fall off a bike, you break your arm, and the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points at it and says, there it is.
Exactly. It's binary.
Yeah, it's broken or not broken, it's clean, it's actionable.
Yeah.
But when it comes to chronic pain, suddenly that x-ray machine is just, well, it's useless.
Completely
We're
useless.
looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky, and yet, I mean, it dominates the lives of over 50 million
It's just a
Americans.
staggering number,
It
really.
really is. So today we are doing a deep dive into some groundbreaking new neuroscience for you. Specifically, we're looking at a massive May 2026 paper from the OOTW Journal.
Yeah, it's titled Psilocybin and Chronic Pain: The Neuroscience of Breaking the Pain Cycle.
Right. And the core premise here, our mission for today, is exploring this idea that we have been looking at the wrong organ entirely.
We really have.
Like, chronic pain isn't a problem with your body, it's a reorganization of your brain. And the wild part, the key to resetting it might actually be psilocybin.
It is a profound shift, honestly. I mean, how we view human suffering is fundamentally changing with this.
Yeah.
We're just talking about a condition that costs the United States over $600 billion annually.
Wow, that's
Yeah, it outpaces diabetes, heart disease, and cancer combined.
combined. I didn't realize it was that high.
It is. And for decades, our absolute primary pharmacological response has been, well, opioids.
Right.
And as we know, that approach created an addiction epidemic while spectacularly failing to cure the underlying disease for millions of people.
It was just a complete failure on the chronic front.
Exactly. But reading through this new research, the reason why opioids failed becomes, glaringly obvious. We were treating a software and network architecture issue with a sledgehammer that was meant for acute local injuries.
Right. Yeah, we've been treating chronic back pain or nerve pain like a broken bone, like an issue happening out there in the peripheral tissues.
Exactly.
But to really grasp what this psilocybin research is doing, it seems like we first have to completely unlearn that traditional model of pain that, most of us grew up with.
We really do, because the traditional model is very straightforward. I mean, it's what medical students were taught for generations.
Right.
You experience tissue damage. So let's say you accidentally touch a hot stove,
Ouch. Yeah.
right? That immediately sends a nociceptive signal through your peripheral nerves, up your spinal cord, and into your brain, where it's interpreted as pain.
Okay, so a direct wire from the hand to the brain.
Exactly. You pull your hand away, the burn heals, the signal stops, and the pain goes away.
Simple cause and effect?
Right. And to be clear, that model is perfectly accurate for acute pain.
Right, the short-term stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the neuroimaging revolution of the past 20 years has revealed that this model just falls apart completely when pain becomes chronic.
Because the signal isn't just like getting stuck in the on position, right?
Yeah.
The brain itself is physically changing its shape to accommodate the pain.
It structurally reorganizes. Yeah.
That's
There's a
wild.
pioneer in this field, Evgenia Apkarian at Northwestern University.
Okay.
And he's spent about 3 decades tracking what he calls the transition to chronic pain. He made a discovery that really rattled the neurology world. He found that when acute pain is not resolved in a normal, healthy time frame, the brain's gray matter density literally shifts locations over time.
Wait, shifts locations? Like the actual mass of the brain moves?
Essentially, yes.
You're kidding.
No, the processing shifts away from the sensory regions. So areas like the somatosensory cortex and the thalamus, which handle the immediate objective sensation of, my hand is burning.
Right, the physical touch part.
Yeah. And it moves toward the emotional and self-referential processing regions,
Oh,
specifically the prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate
wow.
cortex.
Okay, let's pause and unpack this because that is a massive conceptual leap.
It really is.
You're saying the pain moves from the part of the brain that simply processes physical touch into the part of the brain that processes, like, who I am and how I feel about things.
That is the biological reality of chronification. Yes.
That's terrifying.
It is. It stops being a sensory event and becomes an emotional and cognitive state. And this isn't just some slight functional quirk either.
What do you mean?
Well, Apkarian ran these incredible longitudinal studies where he took patients who had back pain for 3 months.
Okay.
And by simply looking at the degree of early prefrontal brain activity, that emotional processing center, he could predict with 85% accuracy whether they would still have that same back pain a full year later.
Wait, wait. They can predict if my back will hurt a year from now just by looking at the front of my brain today?
They can.
That is mind-blowing.
Right, because the severity of the original back injury does not actually predict the chronic pain.
It doesn't.
No. The brain's reorganization does. To put it bluntly, chronic pain is a learned brain state.
Wow. It's like, okay, it's like a smoke alarm that keeps blaring even after the kitchen fire is completely put out.
That's a great way to think about it.
But the blaring goes on for so long, and it's so incredibly intense, that it literally rewires the house's electrical system until the alarm is the default state of the house.
Yes.
The house physically forgets how to be quiet.
That analogy holds up beautifully,
yeah,
because the alarm essentially becomes autonomous. It doesn't need a fire anymore.
Right.
So the natural question becomes, if the brain is rewiring itself, what exactly is it rewiring into?
Okay, yeah.
And the answer lies in a network of the brain called the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN. I know we talk about the DMN a lot on this show in the context of, you know, psychology, depression, daydreaming, that sort of thing.
Right.
But here the source material is saying it's driving a physical pathology.
Exactly. The clinical term for what happens is central sensitization. This is a state where the central nervous system becomes so hypersensitive that it amplifies ordinary signals way beyond what the peripheral nerves are actually sending.
Oh, man.
Yeah, this results in allodynia, where a light breeze against your skin feels agonizing.
Just a breeze.
Just a breeze. And hyperalgesia, where genuinely painful stimuli are amplified to just unbearable levels.
That sounds exhausting.
And neuroimaging shows that this sensitization is driven by that default mode network, which, you know, acts as the brain's core self-modeling system.
Right. It's the narrator, the part of the brain that tells the story of who you are and what your life is like.
And in a chronic pain state, that narrator gets trapped in a horror story.
Ugh.
The DMN starts running a continuous low-level simulation of pain.
It's simulating it.
Yes. It becomes hyperactive even when you are perfectly at rest. It anticipates and preloads the experience of pain before any actual peripheral signal arrives from the body.
So it's basically guessing that you're going to be in pain, so it just makes it happen.
Exactly. The brain isn't waiting to receive pain information. It is actively generating it based on its own expectations.
Okay, I have to push back here on behalf of the listener, though.
Sure.
Because when we talk about a narrator and the brain generating pain based on a story, does that mean the pain is, quote unquote, all in your head?
Right.
Because I can imagine that sounds incredibly dismissive to someone who is out there listening, living with debilitating, disabling physical pain every single day.
That is a crucial distinction to make, and it's where the medical community has historically really failed chronic pain patients.
Yeah, gaslighting them, basically.
Exactly. When neuroscientists say the pain is generated by the brain, they are absolutely not saying it is imaginary, made up, or purely psychological.
Okay, good.
The pain is 100% physically real. The agony, the burning, the aching, it being fully realized by the central nervous system.
Right.
The brain's hardware is firing the exact same pain circuits as if your arm were currently caught in a bear trap. It is as real as any physical sensation can be.
Okay, so it's not fake.
Not at all. It is simply uncoupled from peripheral tissue damage. It's a hardware malfunction in the biological amplification system, not a fire in the arm.
Got it. So the suffering is utterly real. The source is just systemic rather than local. That makes a lot of sense.
Right.
And the researchers like Tor Wager at Columbia and M. Catherine Bushnell at the NIH, they call this cognitive loop pain catastrophizing, right?
Yes, they do.
The DMN creates this rigid pain identity. The internal monologue hardwires into, you know, I'm a person who has chronic pain, and I always will be.
And that rigid identity, ruminating on the pain, magnifying its threat, is one of the strongest predictors of poor outcomes across every chronic pain condition.
Wow.
Now, standard medicine tries to fix this using cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT.
Sure, talk therapy.
Right. A therapist works with the patient to challenge those catastrophic narratives.
Yeah.
But CBT is notoriously slow and effortful.
I can imagine.
You are asking a patient to use their conscious mind to update a highly consolidated, fiercely guarded DMN belief structure, piece by tiny piece, while they are actively in agony.
Which feels like trying to dismantle a brick wall with a plastic spoon.
That's exactly what it's like.
So if therapy takes months or years because you're fighting an ingrained identity, how do we disrupt it rapidly?
Right.
And I'm guessing this is where the psychedelic science finally enters the picture in this paper.
This is where the paradigm completely fractures.
Okay, let's hear it.
Psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, it metabolizes into psilocin in the body.
Right.
And it acts as a partial agonist at a very specific set of receptors called 5-HT2A serotonin receptor.
5-HT2A. Got it.
Now, what makes this so targeted is that these specific receptors happen to be densely packed in the exact anchor nodes of the default mode network.
Oh, wow.
Primarily the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex.
Wait, and those are the exact same regions you mentioned earlier that become hyperactive and swollen with gray matter when acute pain turns into chronic pain.
The overlap is undeniable.
That's crazy.
It is. When psilocybin activates those 5-HT2A receptors, it severely disrupts the synchronized electrical oscillations that allow the DMN to function as a rigid, unified network.
Okay.
Robin Carhart-Harris at Imperial College London developed a model for this with Carl Friston back in 2019. It's called the Rebus model.
Rebus.
Under psilocybin, internal DMN connectivity drops sharply, and the brain enters a state of increased flexibility known as neural entropy.
Okay, you're going to have to walk me through the Rebus model.
Sure.
What does that stand for, and what does it actually mean in the context of my nervous system generating pain?
So Rebus stands for relaxed beliefs under psychedelics.
Relaxed beliefs under psychedelics.
Okay. The core idea revolves around something called precision weighting.
Precision weighting.
Yeah. In a chronic pain state, the brain has assigned extreme precision or certainty to its predictions of pain.
Oh, I see.
It fully expects you to be in agony when you stand up, so it generates the pain signals to match that expectation, which then confirms the belief.
Yeah.
It's a miserable closed loop.
So the brain is essentially preloading the pain because it's so arrogantly certain it knows what's going to happen.
That is exactly what is happening.
Wow.
Psilocybin forces the brain to drop that arrogant certainty. It relaxes the precision weighting.
Okay.
It temporarily shuts down that top-down amplification.
Yeah.
And because the brain isn't screaming its own predictions anymore, suddenly the bottom-up sensory information, the actual, perhaps totally normal, signals coming from your healed back or your limbs can finally get through.
Okay, let me see if I can translate this.
Go for it.
It's essentially acting like a forced reboot for a computer when a background application is hogging all the memory and crowding the system.
I love that.
Like, you hit Control-Alt-Delete, it temporarily shuts down the malfunctioning software, the rigid pain identity, so the system can restart without that heavy, corrupted app running in the foreground.
The computer reboot analogy is the best way to visualize the disruption phase. But, you know, disruption is only step one.
Right.
We all know that if you force restart a broken computer, but the underlying hard drive is actually damaged, the app is just going to crash again the minute you launch it.
Oh, for sure. So if the psilocybin wears off after, what, 6 hours, why doesn't the cane just come rushing back?
Exactly.
How is the brain physically fixing the hardware so the relief lasts? Because the OTW Journal highlights that we aren't talking about taking psilocybin every day like ibuprofen.
Right, definitely not.
We're talking about single or very infrequent doses having effects that last for weeks or months. That has to require physical structural changes in the brain.
It does. And to understand how it builds new hardware, we have to talk about neuroinflammation.
Okay.
We now understand that the brain's resident immune cells, called microglia, play a massive role in sustaining chronic pain. Yes. When you have an initial injury, pro-inflammatory cytokines, specifically molecules called IL-6 and TNF-alpha, they cross the blood-brain barrier and activate these microglia.
Let's translate that for a second. So the microglia are like the brain's microscopic immune infantry, and these cytokines are the alarm bells waking them up.
Yes, perfect translation. And when the alarm rings, they shift into a state known as the pro-inflammatory M1 phenotype.
Wait, hold on. M1 phenotype. Are we saying the brain's immune system has different modes it gets stuck in?
That is a brilliant way to look at it, yeah.
Okay.
Think of the M1 phenotype as the attack and amplify mode.
Attack and amplify.
Right. When microglia are stuck in this M1 state in the pain processing regions, they actively lower your pain thresholds and amplify synaptic transmission.
Oh, geez.
They're literally throwing biological fuel on the fire.
That's...
And here is where psilocybin shows a completely unique mechanism. Preclinical studies, including a major 2020 study by Bott and colleagues, show that psilocybin actually forces these microglia to shift out of that M1 phenotype and into an anti-inflammatory M2 phenotype.
So it forces the immune cells to switch from attack mode to repair mode.
Yes.
It literally cools the neuroinflammation at a cellular level.
It cools the fire, yes. The BOT study showed reduced microglial density in rodents and significantly decreased levels of those inflammatory cytokines.
That is incredible.
But cooling the fire is just clearing the plot of land. What happens next is astonishing.
What happens next?
A 2021 study by Shao demonstrated that a single dose of psilocybin increases dendritic spine density in the prefrontal cortex by about 10% within 24 hours.
Wait, 10% in a single day?
In 24 hours.
Just so I'm understanding, we're not talking about a temporary chemical wash here. That's structural.
Highly structural.
That is the physical architecture of the brain expanding. It's like planting a forest and watching it sprout overnight. How is that physically possible?
It borders on science fiction, honestly. But it is an observable biological fact.
Yeah.
And those new neural connections persist for at least a month.
A whole month.
And here is why this structural growth matters so profoundly for chronic pain.
Yeah, lay it on me.
If you recall our discussion on Apurian's research earlier, in a chronic pain state, the prefrontal cortex, which is supposed to act as the logical brakes on the default mode network to stop pain amplification, it becomes exhausted and atrophied.
Right. It loses gray matter.
Yes.
So by inducing this rapid 10% growth in the exact same area, psilocybin is physically rebuilding the brain's braking system.
It is restoring top-down regulatory control.
Wow.
However, this also carries a crucial caveat for how we view this treatment.
Okay. What's the catch?
It means psilocybin shouldn't be viewed as a standalone magic bullet. It opens a 30-day window of extreme hyperplasticity. It's the ultimate primer. If a patient wants to permanently rewrite their pain identity, that one-month window is when they must engage in intensive physical rehabilitation, graded exercise, and cognitive behavioral therapy.
Well, because the brain is finally malleable enough to accept the therapy?
Exactly. The drug creates the biological soil for healing. The therapy is what wires those new connections into permanent, adaptive, pain-free habits.
That makes perfect logical sense. You reboot the system, you upgrade the RAM, and then you have 30 days to install a better operating system before the concrete sets again.
Precisely.
Okay, so the biological mechanisms make incredible sense on paper. But I want to know how this holds up for real people.
Sure.
Because we're talking about patients suffering from the most extreme, intractable forms of pain known to medicine.
Absolutely. To see the clinical proof, we have to look at cluster headaches.
Okay.
If you aren't familiar, they're colloquially known as suicide headaches. And for terribly good reason.
Yeah, I've heard they're excruciating.
They routinely hit a 9 or 10 on the numerical pain scale. The agony is centered sharply around the eye, can happen multiple times a day, and patients describe it as, you know, an ice pick through the skull.
Oh, God.
And standard treatments often completely fail to touch it.
But the article highlights a really groundbreaking 2021 double-blind study out of Yale led by Emmanuel Schindler. What did they find there?
Schindler's team tested psilocybin on patients with episodic or chronic cluster headaches. They used a dose of approximately 10 milligrams for a typical adult.
Okay.
The results were staggering. A majority of the patients in the psilocybin arm saw a 50% or greater reduction in the frequency of their attacks.
A 50% reduction from one dose.
Yes. And crucially, just as the mechanism suggests, this benefit lasted for weeks beyond the actual time the drug was in their system.
Here's what jumps out at me about that study, though. 10 milligrams is remarkably low. Like, if you look at the psilocybin trials for major depression or end-of-life anxiety, they are typically using 25 to 40 milligrams to induce a profound, ego-dissolving, mystical psychedelic experience.
Right.
10 milligrams is often considered sub-psychedelic. You might feel slightly altered, colors might be brighter, but you aren't dissolving into the cosmos.
And the implications of that are massive for scalability.
How so?
Well, one of the biggest bottlenecks to psychedelic medicine is the requirement for two trained therapists sitting with a patient for 8 straight hours in a highly controlled setting.
Oh, right. That's incredibly expensive.
It is.
Yeah.
But if the analgesic mechanism, the neuroinflammation cooling and the dendritic spine growth, if that can be triggered at sub-psychedelic doses, it means millions of patients might get profound pain relief without needing a full supervised hallucinogenic trip.
Which totally opens the door for treating widespread central sensitization disorders.
It does.
Take fibromyalgia, for example, which affects roughly 4 million Americans. It is the textbook definition of central sensitization, right? It's widespread, migrating pain with absolutely no peripheral tissue damage to point to. And FDA-approved meds for it, like duloxetine, often fail miserably.
Because fibromyalgia is essentially a DMN-driven pain pathology. The neuroimaging of a fibromyalgia patient perfectly matches the central sensitization model we've been discussing.
Really?
Yeah. Hyperconnectivity, the default mode network, increased insula activation, and reduced prefrontal gray matter.
Wow.
The mechanism aligns perfectly, which is why there is currently a formal clinical trial underway at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which began in 2024, specifically testing psilocybin for fibromyalgia.
Taking all of this together, I really want to look at how this redefines the future of pain management.
Okay.
If we contrast this emerging psychedelic science with our current standard opioids, we're looking at two entirely different universes of medicine, aren't we?
We truly are. Opioids act on mu opioid receptors. They are incredibly effective at dampening acute immediate signal transmission. If you break your femur or you are recovering from a surgical incision, opioids block that intense physical signal at the spinal cord level so you can endure it.
But for chronic pain, as we mentioned earlier, they don't just fail to heal it. They actively make the central sensitization worse.
They do. Long-term opioid use causes a phenomenon called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, or OIH. The continuous daily stimulation of the mu opioid receptors causes the nervous system to adapt defensively by upregulating glutamate receptors.
Okay, so it fights back.
It literally activates descending pain facilitation pathways. It makes the nervous system more sensitive to pain over time.
That is so counterproductive.
It exacerbates the exact underlying pathology of chronic pain.
Which totally explains why chronic pain patients on opioids constantly need higher and higher doses just to achieve the same baseline relief.
Yes.
And sometimes they end up in more generalized pain than if they had never started taking them at all.
It's a tragic cycle. But psilocybin operates entirely outside of that system.
Completely orthogonal.
Yes. Psilocybin does not bind to mu opioid receptors at all. Because of that, it carries zero risk of respiratory depression, which is the mechanism that causes fatal opioid overdoses. And it causes no neurobiological tolerance in the way opioids do.
That's huge.
It attacks the pain from an entirely different angle, disrupting the DMN and rebuilding the prefrontal cortex.
So it's fundamentally not about blocking a signal, it's about restructuring the amplifier.
Exactly. And this leads to a fascinating open question in the medical field.
What's that?
Because these two drugs operate on entirely different bodily systems, they aren't necessarily mutually exclusive.
Oh, interesting.
We might be looking at a future protocol where opioids are used very sparingly to handle severe acute flare-ups, just to bring the volume down temporarily, while psilocybin-assisted therapy is used to tackle the underlying DMN dysregulation over the long term.
Wow, a combined approach.
Right, and we're seeing the long tail of this research expanding rapidly. Schindler's group also found that psilocybin resulted in a 50 to 80% reduction in migraine frequency.
That's incredible.
There are trials currently looking at neuropathic pain, the nerve damage caused by diabetes or chemotherapy, where this same combination of DMN disruption and microglial modulation seems to be remarkably effective.
So to pull all of this together and summarize our deep dive for you today, chronic pain is not just a peripheral injury that stubbornly failed to heal.
No, it's not.
It is a learned brain state. It is an architectural shift where the brain's default mode network traps you in a continuous amplified loop of suffering, generating a rigid pain identity.
Beautifully said.
And psilocybin offers a profoundly new approach by temporarily dissolving that rigid identity, cooling the neuroinflammatory fire at a cellular level, and opening a 30-day window of explosive neuroplasticity to physically rebuild a pain-free baseline.
It finally allows us to stop treating the symptom and start treating the system.
And I want to connect this directly back to you listening right now. If you or someone you love has been battling high-impact chronic pain, and you spent years feeling like the medical establishment is gaslighting you, telling you there's nothing structurally wrong with your body while you are living in total agony, this science fundamentally validates you.
It absolutely does.
Your pain is real. It is systemic. It is not an imaginary ghost. It is deeply rooted in neural architecture that we are finally learning how to unlock.
It is a remarkable frontier.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises an important question, one that I think is worth pondering long after this deep dive ends.
What's that?
Well, if a highly targeted molecule like psilocybin can literally disintegrate a rigidly held pain identity in the default mode network, an identity that feels as absolute and permanent as bone, it makes you wonder, what other deeply ingrained identities is your brain rigidly holding on to?
Wow.
An identity of chronic stress, an identity of limitation or aging. What if the things you believe are permanent facts of who you are simply reversible habits of a highly plastic brain?
A completely reversible habit of a highly plastic brain. Think about that. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.